and economic uncertainty. Truss was officially appointed after meeting Queen Elizabeth II at Balmoral Tuesday morning. Her predecessor, Boris Johnson, had earlier issued his final speech outside Number 10 ahead of resigning his post.
This is it, folks. Thank you, everybody, for coming out so early this morning. In only a couple of hours, I will be in Balmoral to see Her Majesty the Queen. And the torch will finally be passed to a new Conservative leader.
Truss has secured the faith of the Tory membership. However, polling suggests the Conservatives have lost favour with the wider electorate. But Truss supporters believe she has what it takes to turn things around.
Liz Truss wasn't responsible for the mess that the country is now in. Indeed, Rishi Sunak, her rival as Chancellor of the Exchequer, he was behind many of the policies which involved an increase in the national insurance, basically a tax on jobs, and of course inflationary policies that have exacerbated the crisis that Britain is currently in. So Liz Truss will be a new broom that will come in and perhaps sweep up the mess that Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson, her predecessor as Prime Minister, created.
Allegations have been spread of a possible plan by Boris on returning to power, agitating from the backbenches to undermine Truss's leadership, as he did under David Cameron and Theresa May.
Boris Johnson, to be honest, I met him and he is like unpredictable. He can do anything. I think at the moment he will be away for a while, but he must have a plan. Always he have a plan. Boris, he like stay for a little while, then he have something else. So he's not going to stop for sure.
Truss's first big challenge will be dealing with the cost of living crisis. She's pledged a clear plan within a week, with expectations of a cap freeze on energy bills. But winter looms and bills remain eye-wateringly high.
Even before Truss took office, speculation has swirled regarding whether she has what it takes or not to save the economy, fight off backbench criticism, and also to hold on to power for the Conservatives in a general election, the next being scheduled for January 2025, meaning that Truss will have to make a meaningful impact and quickly in order to hold on to her position at Number 10 for the long term. Robert Carter, London.
The Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in August 2021 brought about rapid and momentous changes to the country's economy, which was already reeling under the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, persistent insecurity, and weakened private sector confidence. Following the power shift, the war-torn country's economic activities were greatly affected, with the private sector being hit hard. Many private firms have experienced a drastic decline in consumer demand for their products and services. A survey by the World Bank shows that many firms in Afghanistan are adjusting to the new business environment, but most are still facing daunting challenges. The majority of private firms have responded to those challenges by laying off employees, shifting to cash and informal payment channels, shrinking investments, and lowering staff salaries.
Today, factories are facing a lot of problems, especially with raw materials, oil and power. In our factory, we did our best to continue work. However, we were forced to reduce the number of our employees from 120 to 60. We also made some changes to salaries. We're trying to survive at any cost in this harsh situation so that we can help some people put food on their tables and make ends meet.
The survey has also found that employment remained around 50% lower than before August 2021. Most firms are operating below their full capacity and are only considered partially open. This, as U.S. sanctions have disrupted international payments and limited access to bank accounts and formal banking.
The biggest challenges the Afghan private sector is facing are the new government's unrecognized status and banking problems. You know that Afghanistan is importing raw materials from abroad, but today our business people are unable to transfer their money. The cruel sanctions are not posing any pressure on the ruling Taliban, but on the private firms and the welfare of our people. Our country needs to be considered as a member of the global village once again and start interacting with the world.
In the meantime, the new survey confirms the resilience of Afghanistan's private sector, which can play a key role in the economic recovery of the country and improving the livelihood of the Afghan people. Private sector firms in Afghanistan are impacted by the loss of international assistance and banking relationships. Business people here are calling for positive cooperation between the Taliban and global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
For the first time since the beginning of the UN-brokered agreement in April, Yemenis are waiting in long lines in front of a limited number of operating petrol stations in the capital Sana'a to refill their vehicles. Yemen is suffering from a fresh fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's ongoing blockade.
The Saudi-led coalition wasn't sincere in implementing the terms of the armistice, and it did not open flights to other destinations from Sana'a Airport, and the salary issue still persists. The enemy is still using various methods to pressure the Yemenis, such as seizing fuel ships. But our leadership is studying the positions that can be taken regarding the Saudi violations of the UN armistice. There will be an appropriate decision at the right time, as the leadership is keen to move towards a solution to end the war.
The Yemeni Petroleum Company announced the implementation of the emergency plan and is distributing fuel to a few stations only. It held the United Nations responsible for the consequences of the Saudi violation, as it did not ensure the implementation of the armistice terms that included allowing fuel ships to enter Yemen without any restrictions.
The fuel crisis that the liberated areas are experiencing contradicts the United Nations statements that there is a smooth flow of entry of fuel ships into the Port of Hodeidah. If there had been a smooth entry, we would not have experienced this crisis. The UN is a clear partner in decision posed on the Yemeni people because it did not force a Saudi-led coalition to implement what was agreed upon. We hold the United Nations responsible for the continued violations of the Saudi-led coalition.
Since the beginning of the truce, only 33 fuel ships out of 54 have entered the country. However, Riyadh is still holding 9 fuel ships despite them obtaining UN permits, and this is a clear violation of the UN brokered agreement.
Observers believe that the Saudi seizure of oil ships and the Yemeni army's recent military parades indicate a return to military escalation. They say the UN brokered truce has failed to achieve tangible results in relieving the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. Abu Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Liz Truss has begun celebrations after winning the race to become the new leader of the ruling Conservative Party, making her the next British Prime Minister, beating her rival finalist Rishi Sunak and taking over the post from her predecessor Boris Johnson. The Foreign Secretary, who won 81,326 votes of Tory members to the former Chancellor's 60,000, takes over from Boris Johnson, who was ousted by his own MPs earlier this summer.
I'd like to pay tribute to my fellow candidates, particularly Rishi Sunak. It's been a hard-fought campaign. I think we have shown the depth and breadth of talent in our Conservative Party. Friends and colleagues, thank you for putting your faith in me to lead our great Conservative Party, the greatest political party on earth.
The feeling of joy over her victory will not last long. Truss has taken over a car crash economy and a so-called zombie government. Building a new cabinet, formulating an effective energy plan, and figuring out how to remove pressure of the severe cost of living crisis are all top of the agenda.
Things in Britain do need to change. We need some new policies, because what's been happening recently is there's a cost of living crisis, an energy crisis. Inflation is at its highest amount for several decades now, and this is alarming. Britain's economic future is quite bleak. Businesses are suffering. Indeed, there could be the position that many factories may have to close, perhaps temporarily, because simply they cannot afford the fuel bills. So something, in a sense, must be done.
Truss inherits a deeply divided party. Lagging in the polls and a long line of past scandals have left many experts fearing lasting damage to Tory electoral prospects. Truss won't officially take over until Tuesday after a meeting with the Queen alongside the outgoing Mr. Johnson. However, her next big fight will be to convince the wider electorate that her premiership has a future. Robert Carter, London.
Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that a price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to mark the first anniversary of the Gilboa prison break, also known as the Freedom Tunnel operation. In September of last year, six Palestinian detainees escaped from the Gilboa maximum security prison in occupied northern Palestine. They managed to get out through an underground tunnel in the prison's drainage system. Hamas resistance movement has vowed to secure the release of Palestinian detainees.
On the first anniversary of the heroic Gilboa escape operation, we salute the six prisoners. Securing the release of all prisoners is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. The six escapees will be on top of the list of any future prisoner swap deals with the Zionist entity.
The Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions. The prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Palestinian prisoners escape from Israeli prisons because of the horrible detention conditions. They suffer from inhumane treatment, and hundreds of prisoners are held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention.
Palestinian prisoners regularly go on hunger strikes and protest at the regime's administrative detention policy and harsh conditions. Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
We call on all international human rights organizations to step in and protect Palestinian prisoners. There are thousands of prisoners, including children and women, in Israeli custody. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from all forms of oppression inside Israeli jails.
Currently, around 5,000 Palestinians, including children and women, are languishing inside Israeli jails.
People here consider Palestinians held in Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters who continue to struggle under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Did the UK authorities cover up the trafficking of three British schoolgirls who joined the notorious Daesh terror group back in 2015? That is the question now being asked following shock allegations revealed in a new book, which claims that Canadian intelligence officers informed British police that the girls had entered Syria with the help of a double agent, Mohammed al-Rashid, who provided information to Canada on who he had smuggled to ISIL. One of the girls involved is the former UK citizen Shamima Begum, who is currently fighting for a return to Britain under the argument she was groomed by traffickers.
An inquiry has been demanded after it emerged that Canada knew about the teenager's fate but kept silent while the Metropolitan Police ran a frantic international search for the trio. The book has claimed that Canada privately admitted its involvement only when it feared being exposed and successfully asked British authorities to cover up its role. The scandal has now reopened the debate over stripping Begum of her nationality.
Following the latest allegations, we spoke with the Begum family lawyer for his reaction.
Now, the reason that was rather egregious for us was because we had asked specifically the Met Police at the end of March 2015 about updates regarding anything that could be coming of use from al-Rashid, and they confirmed that they had no updates, and that clearly is not the case if what Richard Walton is saying is actually true in this book. This revelation about Canadian security services asset being one fundamental element that allowed these girls to cross over, well, that speaks against error. It speaks more to a concerted, securitized effort to have these girls go across, and that's actually true of the Canadians. The question remains of whether other security agencies who were working with these girls, with these handlers of this Canadian asset, who wanted the same thing. And that's a question, and that's why an inquiry is very important.
A spokesman for the UK government said they do not comment on operational intelligence or security matters, but choosing to remain silent won't be enough to quell the growing questions surrounding the way Western intelligence dealt with Daesh or their sophisticated smuggling operations, which saw so many Westerners slip through the net, including the young and vulnerable. Robert Carter, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepest me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
An unusual attack has taken place in Afghanistan. Days ago, a suicide attack hit the Russian embassy there, killing two Russian staff members. This was the first strike on a diplomatic mission since the Taliban regained control. It was claimed by the Daesh Khorasan, or Daesh group, but why was the Russian embassy targeted? That's a key question. Is there a connection behind this attack with the U.S. in any shape or form, who is on a war footing with Russia in Ukraine? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether there is a U.S. Al-Qaeda or Daesh connection. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Judith Fellow, senior member of United National Anti-War Movement, joins us from Rochester, New York. Also joining us, Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. joins us from Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ken Stoll, let me first start with you and find out from you if you have an explanation as to why there would be an attack on the Russian embassy in Afghanistan, where two Russian staff members were killed, the first strike on a diplomatic mission since the Taliban regained control.
Well, we need to note that ISIS, Daesh, claimed responsibility for the attack, and we know from history that ISIS is a U.S. asset. It was created by the U.S. in order to, two reasons, to destabilize the government of Syria and the U.S. attempt at regime change there, which failed. And it's also provided a pretext for the U.S. to remain in Syria to this day and also in Iraq. So, and we know that the U.S. is the main backer of ISIS because as early as 2012, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency said that the U.S. would welcome the creation of the Islamic State. And both Vice President Biden years ago, and along with former Secretary of State John Kerry, both let the cat out of the bag in various public speeches, which were televised for the whole world to see, saying that ISIS was indeed a U.S. asset. Now, it's merely speculation at this point, but if it was indeed ISIS which conducted this horrible terrorist attack on the Russian embassy, killing people who were lined up trying to get visas, that is to say Afghani people, plus two members of the staff of the Russian embassy, then we can, and knowing that ISIS is indeed set of the U.S., we can speculate that it's part of the U.S. plan to destabilize the new government of Afghanistan. They have withheld, they have frozen the Afghan monetary resources. They have refused to send food aid and other aid to the starving people of Afghanistan. They have encouraged other countries not to recognize the new government, and the U.S. has not recognized the new government. The Russian government was one of the few countries that did have open diplomatic relations with the new government in Kabul. And perhaps this is the way the U.S. is sending a message to Russia and to the rest of the world. We are not happy with the new government. We don't want you to set up diplomatic missions in Kabul. And this might happen to you next.
All right. Well, Judith Bellow, if you agree with what our guest there, Ken Stone, has said, then would you in turn or by default agree that the stage then is set for these Daesh terrorists, or IS Khorasan, as some call them, to operate then and act on behalf, and given Kent Stone's association there of it being a U.S. asset, to act on behalf of, let's say, foreign governments, in this case the U.S., inside Afghanistan? And what would the gains be?
Well, I do think that Ken has made some very good points. And I think there is another aspect in which this event shows the U.S. initiative and their intention moving forward, because right now the proxy war in Ukraine is losing badly. So the United States has a major investment in a war against Russia where their proxy is going to lose. So they need to have ways to mitigate this outcome. And one way to do that is to open up conflict on other fronts against the Russians. So recently, there have been a lot of attacks in Syria. There have been attacks by Israel and also by the United States against Syrian military and also civilian sites. And there have also been attacks so there's also this attack now coming up in Afghanistan, and Pakistan is also under threat. They have lost their president and are suffering a terrible natural disaster at this point. But I think that the loss of a president who opposed U.S. policy is significant here, because it's another way in which Afghanistan is being destabilized. And this is a problem for the Russians. They cannot commit a lot of resources to dealing with it, but they can't not be aware of it. So it puts them really in a dilemma here. In Syria, people are quite concerned, actually, and they're going, why are the Russians not helping us more? And, of course, the Russians really need to get keep their resources focused in Ukraine at this moment. And now they have a situation in Afghanistan where, again, people are saying, well, what are the Russians going to do? And they are in no position at this moment to mount a major response to this. Uh-huh. So it's going to be interesting to see how international diplomacy, because the Russians certainly aren't alone. They are allied with the Chinese. They have support from other Asian countries, including India. How are they going to deal with this issue? And I think this is going to decide the outcome, really, going forward. It's going to decide the world order going forward, because if the Russians were defeated somehow in Ukraine, the only way that could possibly happen is if they change their focus and moved it to something else. So obviously they can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at what a year and a half ago, Kent Stone, the Russian president said, of which it echoed also some other sources, not echoed, but it was relayed in other sources, and that is that Putin said fighters with experience are being attracted from Iraq and Syria to Afghanistan for military operations. He said at a meeting with the heads of the CIS Commonwealth of Independent States. Now, he called them fighters, but these are terrorists. First of all, how are they being transported? How are they making it there? Who's behind that? Why is that something that is being done at this point?
Well, I mentioned earlier the ISIS and al-Nusra and all the alphabet soup of terrorist organizations inside of Syria are proxy warriors for the U.S. They were recruited, financed, and supported, inserted into Syria in order to defeat the Syrian government as part of U.S. foreign policy. And at the various times that these ISIS fighters were defeated, such as at Raqqa and other places, the U.S. Rounded up the survivors and shipped them off to different bases, including the Al-Tanf base inside of Syria, where there have been three or four attacks recently. Right. And they intend to recycle these fighters and ship them off to other sites, such as Afghanistan, in order to continue the work of the United States in destabilizing governments that it finds are not compliant to its needs. I want to point out that Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current president of Syria, famously said that the French started organizing for the return to Syria the day after they were kicked out of the country. And that is exactly what the U.S. intends to do with Afghanistan. They have not given up after the debacle of last August when they left with their tails between their legs. Uh-huh. They intend to come back into Afghanistan, and this is one means by which they intend to do so.
Well, let's see here. Before I go and turn to Judith Bellow, I'd like to follow her train of thought here. Kent Stone, Judith Bellow talked about how Russia is going to react to what is happening in Afghanistan. The President Putin has said about how he is watching closely these Daesh fighters. Are we looking at a scenario where the purpose that the U.S. has in mind maybe is to try to draw and attract Russia, and not just Russia, into the war scenario in Afghanistan, but also perhaps to draw Iran into this? Because we know that these Daesh terrorists are no friends of Iran, obviously. And, well, it seems like they're not either on the same page as the Taliban, or they have I'm not too sure what kind of relationship they do have. That's something to also ask you. But do you think that that is perhaps one of the intentions, drawing in Russia and Iran maybe through creating instability in Afghanistan? Kent Stone.
Thank you. The United States is on the warpath all over the world at the moment. They are ratcheting up tensions in Taiwan with Pelosi's visit. They are ratcheting up tensions in Kosovo when they try to take away the rights of the Serb residents there. They are ratcheting up tensions in Estonia and in Lithuania with Kaliningrad. And with Iran, they are ostensibly trying to re-enter the JCPOA. But just a week or two ago, the U.S. attacked several bases inside of Syria that they claimed were being used by Iran. Iran denied that they were using these bases, but Iran has the right to be, has been invited to help Syria as an ally in the fight against Daesh, ISIS. In fact, the glorious martyr, General Soleimani, was the leader of the Iranian general, was the leader of the entire fight by the Axis of Resistance against Daesh, and it was a successful fight. But when the U.S. Attacks these bases in Syria, at the time that negotiations are going on about the JCPOA, uh-huh. it leads us to think that the U.S. really doesn't want to have a good permanent relationship with Iran. It's stirring up trouble there as well.
Sure. Well, Judith Bellow, let's see here. I'm still not sure how these terrorists are making their way from either their bases or wherever they're stationed at in Iraq or in Syria to Afghanistan. Tell us if perhaps one of the purposes that they are going to serve there, if they are a U.S. asset especially, is to try to engage Iran and Russia and create instability in Afghanistan in order to have those two countries, since they've cooperated together in Syria, to then be involved in Afghanistan.
I believe that you're correct, that they are trying to draw Iran and Russia into a conflict. It is the one way they can bleed their adversaries in the region. But I think that as far as transporting the fighters, the main thing is they have to say, get them out of Syria, which is pretty easy to do. But I think that the people that are actually paying for them to move around, because once they're not in Syria, they can fly just like anybody else somewhere. So they basically need to get them out of Syria and then transport them to someplace near Afghanistan, for instance, Pakistan. And that is where the situation in Pakistan becomes interesting, because they drove out a president who refused to allow them basing in Pakistan, who refused to support any of their initiatives in the Afghan war, and who refused to even support overflights by drones. So now they need a way to move these people from Syria, for instance, or Libya. They're in Libya too still, to move them into Afghanistan. And one of the ways, say, from Turkey.
All right. Yeah, unfortunately, you're breaking up a little bit there, Judith Bellow. Let me move on to Kent Stone. Kent Stone, so you talked about how the U.S. Is actually keen to maybe get back into Afghanistan. If we're looking at that scenario, we haven't mentioned one country here, and that's China. Are we looking at the fact that the U.S. also, if your assessment there is correct, wants to then use Afghanistan as a launching pad then against China? But then, you know, when that's presented, if you agree, it doesn't go with logic, where U.S. would then be engaged in so many military fronts. Not too sure how he's going to be able to, or you could say, if it's going to be able to execute all these different war scenarios.
The U.S. has a hegemonic agenda. It intends to dominate the world. It can't face up, the U.S. leaders just can't accept the fact that we are now in a multipolar world where they are no longer the sole superpower and can tromp around the world squashing whomever they want. So they are in a sort of desperate and reckless mode in which they are creating tensions everywhere, in, as I mentioned before, concerning China by sending Pelosi to Taiwan. And in Canada, a Liberal MP is leading a delegation next month to Taiwan as well. It's all part of a game of ratcheting up tensions. It may have to do with domestic consumption in the states with in the lead up to midterm elections. It may have to do with creating instability, which is good for the U.S. because in an unstable situation in any given region or country, they can play one side against another, and they can sell arms to all sides, so it's very profitable. Instability is very useful to the U.S. of A., and that's what they're doing in Afghanistan. They tried before, just the way that they're using ISIS now, in my opinion. They used the Taliban before and Al-Qaeda. They used Al-Qaeda before to create incidents to drive the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan and to bring Afghanistan into their orbit. Now that they've lost Afghanistan, they're using ISIS to try and bring it back. And they're destabilizing, not just they're trying to destabilize Afghanistan, but all the countries around it by destabilizing Afghanistan. China and Russia and Iran have done their best to stabilize Afghanistan, bring it back into the international community and help the people of Afghanistan while the U.S. is causing trouble and deliberately starving the people of Afghanistan.
Well, here's the deal, Judith Bellow, that it's somewhat confusing, to say the least, about the role that the Taliban is playing in all of this. We forgot to talk about them. I mean, we're looking at this attack that happened to the Russian embassy, of which IS, Khorasan, or Daesh claim responsibility, okay? We know, obviously, Daesh does not like Iran. There was an attack on Iran's embassy a while ago in Herat, of which there was condemnation from the Taliban government, but they really are responsible for the security of these embassies. And yet, you know, these two embassies have been targeted. What kind of relationship do you think exists between the Taliban and Daesh in Afghanistan? Is there one? Is there not? Are they on what kind of terms are they, if there's any?
Well, I don't think they have a very good relationship. They have the same problem that that ISIS had with al-Nusra in Syria, which is that the Taliban want to govern their country. They want to have control over one place, which is their home. ISIS, on the other hand, claims to want to govern the world. they want to change the world and control the activities there. So they really don't have a common platform other than the fact that they have a similar sort of religious underpinning, which makes them hostile, unfortunately, to Iran. However, I think the Taliban are probably a lesser problem than the ISIS, because ISIS is a threat to everywhere they go. And the fact that they have connections with U.S. intelligence and with other Western intelligence organizations, too, for instance, the British intelligence, is that they're a threat everywhere they go. They use them to start a war in Russia. They use them to cause problems in China. They use them everywhere to soften the ground, so to speak, when the U.S. wants to to have control. So that's one thing. The Taliban, on the other hand, are a group of local guys that really want to have control in their own space. And they believe that they can manage that in a way that will be okay for the people. So in some ways, they actually have parallels with the people who in Iran who had the revolution, which is that they come across a country that's been influenced from the outside, not to its best interest over a long period of time, and they want to regain control within their country.
Very well. Last question to you, Ken Stone, quickly, if you can. The SCO, Secretary General, recently said there's an increase in these militants or terrorists that are arriving in northern Afghanistan, and he said that the leaders are actively interacting with the leaders of other terrorist organizations. Now, by the process of elimination, which country do you think that that they may be talking about? What terrorist organizations from which country?
I can only guess which terrorist organizations you're referring to. However, the main controller of all these terrorist organizations are the U.S. and the U.K. And their game is very clear. At a time when the world is facing multiple health crises and an environmental crises, these countries are stirring up trouble everywhere in the world.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Ken Stone. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Ken Stone from Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Judith Bedell, a pleasure. Thank you so much. Senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement from Rochester. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikovit Takwe and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The role of knowledge-based production in job creation within Iran's economy. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has named the current Iranian year 1401, corresponding to 2022, as the year of production, knowledge-based manufacturing, and job creation. In this program, we shall examine the effects of knowledge-based production on employment and job creation in Iran. Please stay with us. Tackling the problem of unemployment is a real challenge for economies around the world. Unemployment can spark multiple problems. A lot of social ills have their root in unemployment, and solving the problem of unemployment can solve a host of social, psychological, and economic problems. Unemployment is linked to a number of other problems, and countries which have a chronic unemployment problem usually also suffer from widespread poverty, a rising crime rate, a rising divorce rate, drug trafficking, widespread corruption, and a widening gap between the rich and the poor. Unemployment among the young is usually 2 to 3 times the level of unemployment in other age groups, and those who are at greatest risk of unemployment are usually young university graduates who are looking for their first job or who have just started their first job. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, just like in many other countries, long-term unemployment and low-paid part-time jobs pose a real challenge for the government. Unemployment is a source of many social ills. Studies show that unemployment will remain at the top of a list of problems which governments have to grapple with in the future. The recent coronavirus pandemic also led to a significant rise in unemployment worldwide, and the Islamic Republic of Iran was no exception. The pandemic had its maximum effect on unemployment in the spring of 2020, 1399 under Iranian calendar, when 1.5 million people had become unemployed directly as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. Gradually, this figure was reduced, and in the winter of 2021, or winter of 1399 under Iranian calendar, it reached its minimum figure of 300,000 unemployed. Many economists believe that high-tech science and innovation play a bigger role in economic development of countries compared to volume of investments and a free market. In order to achieve a knowledge-based economy, production, manufacturing, education and training on their own are not enough. Rather, the key point is to use applied science and applied technology to boost production and manufacture. In other words, pure science needs to be made applicable and practical and effectively used to make optimum use of the country's resources. This is one of the great advantages of knowledge-based economy. Increased importance of knowledge provides great potential for countries to strengthen their economic and social development by providing more efficient ways of producing goods and services and delivering them more effectively and at lower costs to a greater number of people. The relationship between economic growth and unemployment shows that there is a high correlation between economic growth rate and a decrease in unemployment rates. An increase in the growth rate increases the unemployment rate or decreases the unemployment rate. Since knowledge-based companies contribute significantly to economic growth in Iran, they also play an important role in reducing unemployment in the country. In a knowledge-based economy, the development of knowledge and skills leads to innovation, which in turn will lead to increase in productivity and increase in revenues, and this will result in a decrease in unemployment. In his statement on the second phase or the second step of the Islamic Revolution, the leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei declared, "The Islamic Revolution became the driving force for advancement of science and technology in this country, and we can see the fruits of this today quite clearly. Today, literally thousands of high-tech, knowledge-based companies are active throughout the Islamic Republic of Iran, in such fields as stem cell research, biotechnology, nanotechnology, the nuclear fuel cycle, aerospace and space research, etc. We have seen our non-oil exports grow 60-fold. The number of our production and manufacturing units have grown 10-fold. We have seen the transformation of our industries to modern state-of-the-art industries. And we have become a significant research and development country in the world. The development of knowledge economy is dependent on four main pillars. These are innovation, new technologies, human capital, and enterprise dynamics. Knowledge-based companies produce added value and they create wealth. And this is the driving engine for economic growth. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has clearly stated, manufacturing and production through knowledge-based companies will lead to economic growth and a decrease in unemployment.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.